Well, good afternoon, Juno. It's just a little bit shy of 3 o'clock, and we're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. It's time for Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I have a lineup of guests you would not believe. We're going to have three folks here from the Planetarium. They're talking about a program called Astronomy for Children, but among them is one of the gentlemen who was one of the original folks that worked for the Planetarium. So we've got quite a nice discussion coming up about that. And we'll have the producer, the musical director, and the stage director for King Island Christmas coming in. And we'll find out about the oratorio that is coming up with performances this weekend and next weekend. And Adrian Schwartz from the school district is going to be on our sustainability segment to talk to us about energy savings in the schools. Weather looks like mostly cloudy, highs 26 to 32, northeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight the clouds increase. Locally very windy. We're talking about winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, but downtown Juneau and Douglas will probably see gusts to 35 to 45, and the maximum gusts will be up around 60 miles per hour, so batten down the hatches tonight because it's going to be a windy one out there. It's time now for National Native News, and then we'll be back with Juneau Afternoon.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of a First Nation in northwestern British Columbia, Canada, recently seized equipment left behind by pipeline surveyors. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, they first left a clear warning that the surveyors were trespassing.
The Unistoten clan of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation sent an eagle feather to workers on the pipeline. It also decided to block further work on the right-of-way for a proposed natural gas pipeline. The eagle feather is a symbol that represents the first and only warning of trespassing. The surveyors and everyone else associated with the project were ordered to leave and never return. Chief Togusti says the Unistoten oppose all pipelines on their traditional territory, and he says his people will do whatever they have to stop the pipeline.
It means if they decide to try and come in and remove us from this area, that we're going to be stopping them from doing that as well.
The Wet'suwet'en are made up of five clans with territories that they are expected to manage for future generations. And the Unistoten clan has established a community directly in the path of a proposed energy corridor. A spokesman for the clan says it's been made clear in letters, emails, and meetings that they do not want any pipelines on their land. It's the second time that eagle feathers have been issued to pipeline workers. In 2010, another clan gave Enbridge representatives the trespass warning after an oil spill on the Kalamazoo River. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A tribal night hunt for deer was authorized to begin in the ceded territory of northern Wisconsin 50 minutes after dusk Monday. This is the first hunt of its kind. As Mike Simonson reports, the hunt is being criticized by the state.
The State Department of Natural Resources and Department of Justice say this hunt is illegal and dangerous. But Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission spokeswoman Sue Erickson says they won't wait for a federal court hearing to begin this night deer hunt. Erickson says all tribal members issued hunting licenses have to be certified through marksmanship training. In fact, she says it's odd that the state has issued about 1,000 wolf licenses that includes night hunting, while so far only 74 tribal deer licenses have been issued. She says the tribes believe this hunt will be safe.
They do not think they're asking for anything unreasonable. They have more or less taken the path of let's just quietly go about our business, get this done. We'll jump through all the hoops required, and have really tended to stay away from the media hoopla, which is not the course that the state has taken.
But Erickson wants to make it clear this is not deer shining, where lights are used to attract deer. Both State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen and DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp are calling this deer shining. Erickson says this is using lights to illuminate the target before shooting.
Certainly, of all people, they know the difference between, you know, general shining and illumination at the point of kill. So, yeah, their choice of terminology there was inaccurate, and I'm assuming deliberate.
The tribal night hunt will continue until the first Sunday in January, barring a federal court order. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
The Interior Department announces the final steps in a historic Indian Trust settlement. On Monday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar praised the final approval and outlined steps his department will take to implement the $3.4 billion settlement. It resolves the class action lawsuit Cobell versus Salazar over the federal government's mismanagement of individual Indian trust accounts. It became final Saturday, following action by the Supreme Court. The settlement includes $1.5 billion for 500,000 class members. The lawsuit was filed more than a decade ago. Plaintiffs' lawyers say the first payments should be distributed before the end of the year. Happy birthday to Native radio station KYNR. On this day in 2000, the voice of the Yakima Nation went on the air. KYNR is located in Toppenish, Washington. The station airs national and local programming and broadcasts from powwows, round dances, and school sporting events. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kowanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Kowanic is accepting artwork for the 2013 Alaska Native Art Auction scheduled March 7, 2013. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Call 907-793-3528 for more information. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just about 5.5 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, and I have three guests here, and what promises to be a really interesting discussion. There's a kids program coming up, I think, tonight at the Planetarium, and with me in the studio is John Kramers and Clark Branch, the two guys who I think are going to produce that and present most of the material. But also with us is a special guest from out of town. Michael Orlov is actually back in Juneau. And, Michael, I understand you were one of the original stargazers, I guess, at the Planetarium.
Well, hello,
Juneau. Or star showers.
Yes. Well, hello, Juneau. And it's true that I used to live in Juneau, and now I live in Gresham, Oregon, near Portland. And I've come up to Juneau for a three-day visit, and I specifically planned to be here on the last Tuesday of the month because that's the day when there's a planetarium show at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And I was a volunteer at the planetarium. The planetarium itself started in 1967. That's when it was put in. And during the 60s and the 70s, there was a paid teacher hired by the school district to teach astronomy to all the classes. So that was in the 60s and 70s. But in the 80s, due to budget cuts and other issues, the planetarium was closed as a planetarium. The room was used for storage, for school board meetings, anything but a planetarium. So, but then in the
decorations for school board meetings.
In the 90s, Bill Leedy and Nancy Waterman and other volunteers asked the school district if they could see if the equipment still worked so they could put on shows for the public. And the school board said, okay, and they turned on the machine and it still worked. And so in the 90s, they started putting on free public shows at the planetarium. I went to one of the shows and had a good time. And at the end of the show, the volunteers said, we're just volunteers and we always could use more help. And if somebody else would like to join us, you know, here's when we meet. And so I thought that would be very interesting. And I started volunteering. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 10 years as a volunteer at the planetarium and have had a great time.
Yeah. Have you done anything in planetariums outside?
Well, I am interested in astronomy. I'm a form of a sidewalk astronomer. I have telescopes that I sometimes set up outside, not only in the evening to look at the stars in the night sky, but I have solar telescope with special filters so that you could look at the sun and see sunspots and the prominences and solar flares. So I am interested in astronomy as a volunteer and just have a good time.
Yeah, cool. Well, the equipment that Michael is talking about is still the very same equipment that is going to be used tonight for this kids show and is used for all of the astronomy. Can you briefly describe what we have over there?
Yes, we have a star ball that was made by Spitzer.
This is Clark Branch speaking.
This is Clark Branch, and yeah. Hello, Juneau. We have a star ball that was made by Spitz. It's AP3, I believe, is the model number. And it was built in 67 or 68.
67 was when it was put in.
67, it was installed. So if you do the math, it's quite old, you know, getting on 45 years here. Over the years, we've had some heart-stopping moments when the star ball stopped working, and luckily we've been able to sort through the issues and keep it running.
This is basically, it's like a sphere with holes in it, right? With a bulb, with bulbs inside that shine out through the spheres?
Yes, it has a very special light bulb at the center, and it's a sphere that has holes in it that match where the stars would be in the sky. For a while, we had an extra hole in it, so there was an extra star, but that was fixed.
Black tape?
Yeah, it was an easy fix. Just had to make sure we got the right hole.
Well, I know Click and Clack, you know, periodically, when the show was on, used to tell people if there was a light on their dash, you'd cover it with black tape, it wouldn't bother you anymore. You know?
Right, and that's quite true. And so anyway, but at the same time, the star ball really works brilliantly. It's a, you know, beautiful analog, our star ball. It gives real nice clarity, and it's been, you know, very useful for teaching astronomy and basic constellations and such at the planetarium. We also use other aids too. Tonight's show, if we could talk about that for a moment.
Yeah.
Is basically astronomy for kids or astronomy for children, and the whole idea is just to have a lot of fun activities to hopefully spark the imagination and curiosity of kids into the field of astronomy and science in general. So we will do a brief showing of the stars tonight. We'll focus on being able to find the North Star and how to find it, try to make it relate in a real way for the kids, and then I have a quick PowerPoint presentation with some fun pictures and some fun ideas to talk about. And the ideas that are in the PowerPoint presentation will support the activities that we'll do later on in the show. Then we will also create a human model of the solar system, which is a lot of times a fun favorite.
A human model of the solar system.
Yes.
Okay. You want to explain that just a tiny tad more without doing a spoiler?
That's not entirely self-explanatory. Okay. what we do is and this was a trick I got from Michael Orlov, actually. But we have T-shirts with all the various planets' names on them, as well as some asteroids and comets. And then the very center where the star ball is will be the sun. And then so we'll have a kid put on a Mercury T-shirt and walk around or run around the center, he will be Mercury, or he or she will be Mercury. Uh-huh. And then another one that becomes Venus, and then we'll have an Earth and Moon pair that do a little waltz around, and we work our way out to Mars and the asteroid belt and Jupiter and Saturn, et cetera. And it's just a real way to understand how the planets go around the sun. And then we'll have some comets that go all the way from the outside and past the sun and then back out to the outside. And then all the audience that's left on the very outside perimeter ends up becoming the Oort cloud.
Yeah.
So everybody in there will actually become part of the human model of the solar system.
Right. And you used to do this when you were here?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And we also used to march in the 4th of July parade as the solar system. So we had the marchers wearing the T-shirts representing the different planets, and we had a 200-foot-long rope with the relative distance of where each of the planets were. So we used to march in the 4th of July parade, and people wondered, is Pluto still a planet? And we'd say, you'd have to wait to see who's at the end of the line.
So we still got the rope?
Yes, we still have the rope somewhere, although I think we haven't done that particular float in quite a while.
Yeah, I might volunteer. This sounds like a guess. Okay, so this is tonight. Yeah, that's one.
Yeah,
one show.
So is tonight from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. It's great to arrive at about 5:45.
Yeah.
And then we have some other real fun activities as well. We will create or mimic the Aurora Borealis. And so we'll use the star ball to project stars onto the screen and have the lights turned down, and then we break out a bunch of glow sticks. And we hand out tons of glow sticks to all the kids, And so they run around and have the glow sticks above their heads, creating the aurora borealis. Real fun activity. That was one of the favorites, I think. And then we will also create a nebula right inside the Marie Drake Planetarium. And so I just want to take a moment to thank BRH and especially the maintenance crew at BRH for donating the dry ice that we will use to create the real nebula right inside the planetarium.
Outstanding. You got to have smoke for a nebula or steam .
Right, and it's very, very difficult to find dry ice anywhere, but BRH was kind enough and generous enough to donate it absolutely free for the planetarium show tonight.
So we talked about the star ball, and you're going to be using it tonight, but this is not state-of-the-art for planetariums. What is?
Well, this is John. Right, yeah. And, you know, state-of-the-art now is digital. Mm-hmm. So the digital offers a lot of features that we can't do at the planetarium, at least not especially things that we can't do easily.
Leah, for instance.
Well, for instance, just a simple task of aligning the planets and the stars in the correct locations for this particular time of year. If we ran the Marie Drake Planetarium kind of on a daily basis, it's pretty easy to keep all that stuff in sync, but we don't. We operate the planetarium maybe once a month and some in a few classes in between. And so that stuff gets out of sync really quick.
Uh-huh.
And so setting all that stuff up gets to be a bit of a pain. So the moon is never in the right place, it's never in the right phase. The planets aren't in the right phase or in the right place. So that kind of thing is difficult.
Never forget them.
Computers don't forget them. And the other thing that we can't do very well is, like, say we wanted to show the stars and we wanted to show maybe what a constellation really, you know, the outline of the constellation, so maybe more artistic. We can show a slide, or we used to be able when we had a slide projector that worked on top of it. But with digital, you can kind of show those kind of things real time on the dome. Uh-huh. And it kind of maps out the stars, and it's maybe easier for people to visualize maybe what the constellation shape would be, and so there's a lot of those kind of things, and so there's, you know, laser projectors, and there's all kinds of neat stuff you can do. We just can't do it at our planetarium. But the things that the analog does well. It just certain things it just can't do.
Do you have a sense of how many people come through the planetarium in the course of a year?
I would. Yes, we've been having, you know, it varies, but we have been having at least 40 people, I would say, at a show minimum. Sometimes we've had as many as 190 or something.
Yeah, when Ken does one of those movies, I think the place gets packed up pretty big.
And then in the summer, we it kind of drops off. We don't really do a formal show in the summer, but we've been doing grade B sci-fi movies, and we'll get, you know, maybe 20 people for those.
Mm-hmm.
So overall the year, you know, we get, I would say, 250, 300 people come through.
Well, I think we had counted well over 1,200 attendees last year.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
We've had a few shows that really get full. I think we had one show we actually couldn't accommodate everybody that came.
Yeah.
At one point. But
we had a fundraiser that someone from outside came in, talk about Aurora, I think. He had pictures.
He was a photographer, yeah.
And to pay his, you know, his travel change, that he was on the way to Fairbanks, we raised money for that, and we had to turn people away because
mm-hmm.
we just didn't have any place to put them.
This is a facility that it seems to me, I don't know what the costs would look like if we were to update the planetarium, but it really seems to me like it'd be an incredible idea for Juno, because we are not going to get rid of those clouds up overhead, and it's not going to stop raining here, which means if you want to see the stars, you're going to have to go indoors to do it.
What would
a digital setup at the planetarium cost?
Well, the thing is that the amazing part is, well, if I may, let's lead into that real
quick.
Okay,
good.
Just want to put out there, you know, the planetarium here in Juneau is actually the single largest planetarium dome all the way between Seattle and Fairbanks. So ours is even bigger than Anchorage's. And so that's pretty cool. The facility itself, building that dome and having that building, that's the expensive part of building a planetarium. We could get a new projector. We could get the projector of our dreams for approximately $150,000. And it's kind of a goal. We would love to find a way to raise that money to purchase a digital projector And it would be a quadrangulated projector, so it wouldn't need to utilize the center of the planetarium to be installed. So we could actually have both projectors simultaneously.
Oh, we wouldn't get rid of the ball.
We wouldn't have to get rid of the ball. And I think our current thinking is that we would love to have both systems supplement each other, because the star ball does do some things very well, and it has just a certain look and feel about it that kind of sparks the imagination and, you know, makes people excited. And it does quite well at projecting the stars.
Not to mention that Michael would be probably really seriously upset the next time he comes to Juno with the star ball.
Well, the star ball is really fantastic, because what it can do is can show the night sky from any place on the Earth, North Pole, South Pole, the equator, wherever, and at any time of the year. Today, 4th of July. And so what we do periodically is, if you come to the planetarium show and it happens to be your birthday, we could show you what the stars look like at the place you were born on that day.
All right. I'm going to do that tonight for anybody?
We probably won't have that part of the show tonight, but we do use that quite frequently still.
Okay. All right. So tonight's show, again, is Astronomy for Kids.
Uh-huh.
And you've got all of these wonderful activities lined up. This thing starts at 6 o'clock, but you need to be there about 5:45, right, in order to make sure you got a place to be where you want to be.
Yes, that way people can be in and ready so that we can start the show on time.
Right at 6.
And so, yes, 6 to 7 p.m. at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And it's absolutely free, which is great for families with lots of kids. We've never charged anything. I think... very rarely have we had a couple of fundraisers where we've charged an admission, but those are special circumstances. The show is absolutely free.
Well, check under the seats after the show and make sure we didn't find an angel who drops a $150,000 check on us. Okay, guys. Hey, this sounds fantastic. And Michael, welcome back to Juno.
Okay, thank you. Just for 3 days.
Yeah.
And I picked cold, snowy days.
Yeah, right. But you're going to spend at least tonight indoors.
At the planet.
Are you running a part of it? They're going to give you the joystick.
I'm volunteering. In fact, I planned my trip so I'd be here on the day of the show.
All right. Well, John Kramer, Clark Branch, Michael Orlov, thank you so much for alerting us to this wonderful thing. And I'd like to see something happen on this possible fund drive to fix up that equipment, because if we've got that big in a facility, we need this. We need this. A little music to go out with.
Thanks, Craig.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The stars are coming out like popcorn. The stars are coming out of control. Whoa, whoa, whoa. The stars are coming out like popcorn. With heaven as a bowl, that Milky Way is looking so dreamy. That Milky Way is looking so sweet. That Milky Way is looking so creamy. It's almost good enough for anyone to eat. The stars are coming out like pop, pop, popcorn. They're shooting from the north to the south. Wow, 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 wow. The stars are coming out like pop, pop, popcorn. So go outside and open up your
The music should be recognizable to almost anyone who's been in Juneau for longer than about an hour and a half. And is with me in the studio are the wonderful people who are putting together presentation of King Island Christmas, which opens, I guess, Thursday at Aldersgate Church. So Missouri Smythe, the music director, is here. The stage director, Debbie Smith, is here. And Sharon Gapeman, who is taking care of producing the show and doing an incredible job of arranging publicity for it. is also here. And in the background, you can hear the cast recording from, I don't know what year this one was done.
It's from the New York cast.
New York cast, okay.
And I'm not sure what year either.
Sometime in whenever.
The late 90s.
Either probably. The late 90s or the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but it's pretty special.
Yeah, yeah. So this year's program is going to be pretty special, too. You've got, 60 people on the risers, I think, or something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
What's the total cast?
60. 60. Right, even yeah. at 60, yeah.
And this is friends and neighbors. I mean,
We're counting you among our friends,
well,
Patrick. Yeah.
Well, I'll confess I'm actually up on the stage for this one. This is the first time I've sung in anything like this in for a long, long time.
Yeah.
One of the things that really struck me is the fact that there's a bunch of families involved in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how many family groups there are? My wife and I are in it, and
Let me see. There is the Wellings.
Mm-hmm. If anyone doesn't recognize the distinctive voice, this is Missouri Smythe.
Hi, the Welling family, and then the Lujan family.
The Coopers,
right? The Cooper family.
The Crawfords.
Right,
Brett and Cheryl.
Yes, mm-hmm. And then we have two sisters, the Cordles, Madison and Hannah Cordle.
And then Dan Wayne and his
Dan
girls.
Wayne and his
and
girls.
And Catherine Eldemar.
That's right, and Catherine girls. Eldemar.
Right, which brings up the fact that there's kids in this production as well.
Yes.
The Alaska Youth Chorus is up on the stage.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right.
It's the intermediate and the advanced choir singers.
Okay, and so that's how many young ones are?
That I would say 27.
27 mm-hmm. kids.
Yes.
So it's a daycare.
Sure.
But have you noticed, Patrick, there are parents in the audience every night in charge of those wonderful young voices.
Well, they are some wonderful young voices in there. That's an impressive organization, I have to say. They really can belt it out.
There are some choristers who have been in the choir for, I think they have a competition, and I think Hannah right now holds it. She's been in the choir for close to 10 years, I think it is, and she's a senior in high school this year.
Wow.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
So this is her.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'm really impressed with, Missouri.
This is Sharon.
Yeah, well, the other thing that I'm impressed with are the number of kids who returned to do it again, because, Patrick, as you've noticed, Missouri's quite the taskmaster. And then when Deb came back on the scene, she double-doses that. But you have to be like a very special young person and older person in order to be a part of this. I mean, it's very serious work, and I'm always impressed with what the two of you do.
Well, thanks.
Thank you, Sharon. I appreciate that.
Wow.
I think part of it just comes from my British upbringing when I was born and raised in New Zealand, pretty structured English type of uniformed school. So
I got to tell a story here.
Okay.
Okay. I'm up on the risers watching you.
Yes.
Okay, directing. And yes, there are times when you have to kind of look at us and speak to us sternly, but you have so much fun out there at the if the audience could watch you, they would see a show. We get to see this show every time you direct. And you have the most wonderful facial expressions I have ever seen on a person who is wielding a baton. It's just wonderful.
Wow. Well, it's really interesting because there's a young man by the name of Travis Monagle, of the Monagle family in Juneau. In fact, Kim Kiefer is his aunt. And when Travis was in the choir, he stood right in the middle where the tenors and basses are. And after several performances, his family would come up and they'd say, you know, Missouri, we know exactly what is going on when you have your back behind us? And I said, well, how do you know that? Because Travis imitates every single expression on your face.
So, Missouri, it's Sharon again. I guess what we should do is ask Patrick to step into that role and do it for all eight performances.
I can't. I'm in the back row, but I know a tenor who could pull it off.
It's a great cast, and part of the reason is we have a wonderful men's section in between the tenors and the basses, but they have their own competition going, and it's really fun to watch.
In what way?
Oh, they have inside jokes. And
there's six tenors? Five or six tenors?
Five tenors.
Yeah, five tenors. Mm-hmm. And they've got, they have spirit, man. I mean, this little group of five tenors is fun to watch because there's a lot of places where you've directed us to interact with the audience. And these guys get into the interaction with the audience. I mean, they are really on. Get and it's on. Wonderful watching them watching them play. Go ahead, Sue.
So I'm just wondering, maybe there might be some people who haven't been here for the past 2 years. We did it last time in 2010. But it began at Perseverance Theater. You know, well, it began in 1952 when Ree Mignot was living on King Island and actually was there when the North Star, which is a ship that was bringing the village priest and the winter goods to King Island, and they couldn't land the ship, so to speak. I guess that's what you would say. And in order to make sure the priest got to shore and the goods for the winter got to shore before everything froze up, they carried their umiak, their kayak, over the mountain as a community. And so when Ree moved to Juneau, she eventually told the incredible Gene Rogers about this. Gene wrote a children's book. Then Deborah Vort, who had become a librettist,
playwright.
Well, and also she had been at this program at NYU and was learning how to do Broadway and songs, and she adapted that. She fell so in love with the children's book, she adapted it and got her friend David Friedman, who's known for some Disney productions, to compose the music, and the rest is history. But the really exciting history, I think, this year is on Deb's plate, and I want her to share that part of the North Star story.
Well, my husband worked in the federal building for 13 years, and one of the things that he saw every day when he went to work was this small museum that is on the lobby floor of the federal building after you go through security and all that stuff. There's this lovely little museum that the BIA has put together, and it has representative artwork from all the different Alaska Native cultures, but included in that museum is a display about the North Star. And that includes photographs of the three different boats that were named the North Star, the one, the two, and the three. The third boat was actually decommissioned in about 1964. But included in that display is the original bell. It is engraved on it, North Star, 1932. So that bell was on the ship that actually went to King Island and went around to the lee of the island and had the umiak come out to get it. And we had fun the other day and actually recorded the bell, and Patrick can play it. It's a wonderful resonance, and it's a large bell. And we're very grateful to the BIA, who were very cooperative in letting us actually ring the bell.
And this is Missouri speaking.
Yeah.
When I heard that bell, from a historical perspective, it made for me the King Island production more of a reality, even more, just to hear that resonance of the boat and then to see images of it in your head when you hear that bell, and many of you know the King Islanders' demise after many years of being on King Island. So to hear that bell and to have this production put on and then to think about what they had done is just such a heartwarming and touching tribute, not only to them, but also for us to put it on.
Which is why it's so amazing that Deb, as the stage director, really stripped the story down to just being, I mean, it was produced for years at Perseverance in various locations, and it was absolutely stunning. And Missouri, I know you were a part of the very original one. But Deb's whole take, and maybe you could speak about that, Deb. I love the fact that it's a bunch of just Juno people telling a story about the King Islanders.
Right. Because the music is so wonderful, and the story that the music conveys with the words that Deb has put into the libretto, it's so powerful. You really don't need all the extraneous, you know, costume sets, lights, all those other elements, which can be used, but you don't need them. What you want to be able to do is tell the story of what happened to these people, how they've worked together, what a sense of community they had, and convey that to the audience. So they come in the opening number, they're people who are going Christmas caroling. That's what who they are. They're families who have gotten together to go Christmas caroling, and they tell you the story through song.
One of the most exciting parts of the song, of the singing, is the moment when the villagers are, it's suddenly pointed out to them that the North Star is in the bay, and then they learn that there's a chance that they may not be able to bring the priest ashore. Could we play that piece of music? It's about 2 minutes or so here.
Getting low.
That's all we got. We're out of stock.
I'll bring the ore. We'll have to row.
We need men at the rock.
How many men?
15 or more.
Time to lift the boomy up.
1, 2, 3, 4. Carry her down to shore. Run, run, everyone run. The lots are in the bay. Run, run, everyone run. The lots are in the bay.
When a ship comes in, we paddle out. Our rig is to be on. To bring the priest from ship to shore.
We do not have a dock.
The gulls are flying backwards. The waves are hitting the sky. Our ruby arms are picking up when the ocean gets too high. The Arctic ice is coming. It's moving toward the bay. The very sea is breathing fast.
Listen. What does the ice have to say?
I am coming. Every boat must go ashore. The Arctic ice is something that boats cannot ignore. If they try to, I will catch them when I freeze the Bering Sea.
It looks to me like the storm will last.
We've got to make a decision fast.
Where is Olorado? What does Olorado say?
Everyone go to the school. We must radio the ship right away.
Come, come, everyone come. The North Star's in the bay. The ship's so close, so very close. And yet so far away.
It's about 22 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News, and we're in the middle of a discussion of King Island Christmas on Juno Afternoon. With me in the studio, of course, are the three ladies who are kind of the front end of the show. Missouri Smythe is here, Deb Smith is here, Karen Geipman is here, musical director, stage director, and producer. So a couple of things. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of music in this thing. So without going too far into
sure.
it, what do people expect? What do you expect when you go to it?
Well, I guess what people can expect when they do come to the production is to hear one of the pieces of music we sing is Agudik Maktak, Salmon and Seal, and David Friedman so cleverly wrote it as a calypso piece, and so you'll hear some calypso there. The section when the choir comes into the church, the cast comes into the church to sing, and so he wrote that as a chorale. It's unaccompanied, and so you'll hear four-part harmony as if they're singing a hymn. And then the other piece that I love about the production is he has written almost like a thread of music that continues to go through all 25 pieces of music, and you'll hear it on King Island, which then sews all the pieces together and has mm-hmm. that common thread that, on different levels, community, and so he's cleverly put that through as well. The other piece I love about him and the way he's written is he's got these themes that give it a very mysterious sort of flavor to the pieces of music. He has written piano accompaniment that is a challenge to play, lots of key changes, lots of tempo changes, which add also to the excitement and to the mood of the piece.
And we're very fortunate in having two wonderful accompanists,
good for
Lori
you.
Hagee and Kim Andrews, and they trade off because it's a very, very difficult score to play.
And they do it wonderfully
they
well.
They do.
And I, of course, want to do, in pure public radio fashion, if you haven't gotten your tickets yet for King Island, now's the time to do it. Don't put it off any longer. You can go to the JAG. You can go to either Hearthside location, or you can get them at the door. We're performing it starting this Thursday night at 7:30, Thursday night, Friday night, and then at 3 and at 6 o'clock on Saturday night. And we have to put in a little plug for the Bach Society, which is why we're starting early on Saturday night at Aldersgate. Then next week for Gallery Walk Weekend, we're moving downtown to the Jack. On Thursday night, December 6th, we have a performance that will be signed for the hearing impaired community. So it's December 6th, 7th, 8th is going to be at 7:30 at night, and then a Sunday matinee at 3 o'clock. For more information, call now, 586-ARTS.
And thanks. You can also go online and get tickets on the Jack's
Vendini,
website.
Yes, Vendini, right.
Yeah.
Jack.org.
Right.
I mean, JAHC.org.
Yeah, because I had a friend from Sitka call and ask,
yay!
Well, she's coming up for the show, as a matter of fact.
I love that, Patrick. Keep them coming.
Okay, we'll go out with music. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
No, thank
Missouri,
you.
Missouri, Deb, Sharon, wonderful work, and I'm sure the community is just going to be thrilled with this year's presentation of King Island Christmas.
You're incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. We hope you like. broadcast of this program is made possible in part by the Alaska Budget Report, specializing in the straight scoop on state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 27th of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1786, the poet Robert Burns borrowed a pony and made his way from his home in Ayrshire to the city of Edinburgh. He was a failure at farming, and after he got his girlfriend Jean Armour pregnant, he decided he needed to find a way to support the new family. He already had an illegitimate one-year-old daughter whose mother was a servant in the Burns household, and she wanted some money. So he accepted a friend's offer to go to work in the Caribbean as a clerk in Jamaica, and he was all set to leave in September. A few weeks before his departure, he published poems chiefly in the Scottish dialect, hoping to raise enough money to pay his fare. And the book became so successful that Burns began to doubt that he should leave Scotland. And then Jean Armour gave birth to twins. And at the same time, Burns heard that his book of poems had been favorably received by some influential critics in Edinburgh. And so, full of hope, he borrowed the pony. He made the two-day trip to Edinburgh. Along the way, he was entertained by farmers who had heard about him and who wanted to take him in for the night and to give big feasts in his honor. And he arrived in Edinburgh to find out that he was now famous in Scotland, and the trip to Jamaica was canceled. It's the birthday of the historian Charles A. Beard, born Knightstown, Indiana, 1874, who argued in his book An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution that the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution as a way to protect their own economic interests more than for any ideological reasons. And he also saw the Civil War not as a war that was about slavery, but as a conflict between the agricultural economy of the South and the industrialized economy of the North. It's the birthday of James Agee, born in Knoxville, 1909, best remembered for his autobiographical novel A Death in the Family and his account of Southern sharecroppers during the Dust Bowl, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. But during his life, he was best known as a film critic for The Nation and for Time magazine. And it's the birthday of the filmmaker Les Blank, born in Tampa, 1935, studied English, wanted to be a writer. Everything he wrote was rejected. He stayed in graduate school, wanted to become a teacher, but then his marriage failed and he didn't feel like studying anymore. He dropped out, couldn't find a job doing anything. And then he saw a film by Ingmar Bergman, The Seventh Seal, and it changed his life. He decided to become a filmmaker. Les Blank has made more than 40 films, many of them documentaries about different traditional musicians, Cajun music, the blues, cowboy music, the polka, a film about garlic, and about a man who buys tea in China and brings it back to San Francisco. Here's a poem for today by Robert Bly, entitled Taking the Hands. Taking the hands of someone you love, you see they are delicate cages. Tiny birds are singing in the secluded prairies and in the deep valleys of the hand. Robert Bly's poem, Taking the Hands, from Silence in the Snowy Fields, published by Wesleyan University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at reputation.com. Written by Betsy Allister, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. The theme music tells us that it's time to look at another aspect of sustainability for Juneau, and in the last couple of programs, we've been looking at energy issues. Today, we'll be talking with Adrian Schwartz, Energy Manager at the Juneau School District. I asked Adrian to tell us about her work in reducing energy usage throughout Juneau's schools.
Well, to give you a little bit of background, the Juneau School District started the Energy Conservation Program in 2007 with the help of a company called Energy Education, Inc. at the time. Now they changed their name to Synergistic. In general, at the time we started the program, we established guidelines that we expect all staff to follow. And so a big piece of the program is communicating those guidelines to everybody and making sure everybody's very, clear on what those are.
Now, this goes through all of the buildings and facilities that the school district occupies. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
How different were the things that you had to do by building? Can you give us a little information on that? Did you have to do something vastly different in any of the buildings?
Well, I wouldn't say vastly different. And one thing to keep in mind is I've been in this role as energy manager for about a year and a half now, so I took the place of Joyce Kitka, who was around at the very start of the program. So what I can say is that we follow the same guidelines for all schools, but we do look at each individually in terms of the lighting they have and the different mechanical and heating equipment that they have to see if there's any improvements that need to be made in terms of energy efficiency.
What are the biggest draws, energy draws in the school buildings?
Oh, goodness. The majority of our schools use heating oil for the heating system, and I think three of the schools have dual heat, both electric and heating oil. So heating the buildings is huge, of course. And then we have lights that are needed all throughout the building so that students and staff can be in a environment where they can see and learn. And then we also have quite a bit of equipment in terms of computers and those types of things.
So what kinds of guidelines do you give the people who work in the school system about the equipment and the lights?
Well, in general, the guidelines are communicated to all staff. One thing that's important to know is those are communicated regularly through emails, newsletters. So it goes to all staff, administrators, program supervisors, and in general, we're telling people, if you're not using it, shut it off. So, if you don't need the lights on, turn those off. If you're not using the computer, shut it down. Just common sense, like you would do around the house, or at least I do. I follow around my kids and say, do you really need the light on, or do you really need to take a 15-minute shower? I don't think so.
So, there's a kind of a myth floating around out there about turning off lights.
Mm-hmm.
I think MythBusters has done something with it, the television program. But I'm wondering what you can tell us about the business of turning off a room light when you're leaving. Is there some particular time, length of time that there's a power drain or what?
Well, what I have been told since starting this position is that the myth that I've always heard growing up was that, it didn't save any money unless the lights were off for a certain length of time, or that flipping the switch off and on and off and on was going to cost you more. And that is because there is a power surge when you initially turn on the lights. But if you watch the MythBusters video that I think you can look up online and believe it's on the Discovery Channel, according to that video, that surge is only 23 seconds. Or the amount of time from that surge that, for savings would be 23 seconds of leaving the light on. So you're better off to just shut the lights off if you don't need them.
The guidelines and programs that you've put into effect within the school system are primarily aimed at staff and faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do any education of students in the process?
I that is a goal that I have in mind. And I have worked with a couple of different programs that offer energy conservation curriculum. And I have started to share that curriculum with our staff in hopes that it will be passed on to students. I do also, in the newsletters I put out, I encourage staff to have the students be their helpers because they love it. You know, they love to be in charge of things. And so, you know, you put a student in charge of making sure the lights are shut off or the computers are shut off, and I think they'll definitely help do the job.
The company that you've worked with, what was the name of the company again?
Now it is Synergestic. It has been known as Energy Education Incorporated.
Okay. And Synergestic is located where?
It's located in Texas.
Okay. And do they do this for like other school districts and other institutions?
Yeah. They are actually one of the nation's leading energy conservation program companies, and they work with K-12 schools, college campuses, and other institutions.
Do they send advisors to help you with the decisions?
Yeah, no, they're great. We are actually, we're not currently in contract with them, but they have a lifetime commitment to us. So, you know, that's how they work. Once you've partnered with them, you're on contract for the first few years, and then they commit themselves to you for the, lifetime. And so they actually just recently sent an engineer up here to help look at where we can determine where we need a little bit more energy efficiency.
Did you work with him when he came up?
Yes, I did.
What kinds of things did you do?
Well, he helped us look at each of our schools, and quite honestly, we're doing really well. We submitted an application this last year to Energy Star and received two recognitions. One was a leader top performer because on average, our schools are rating in the top 25% nationwide for similar facilities. And then we also received another recognition for 20% improvement over how our performance was the year before we started the program. And so, you know, honestly, we walked through the buildings to see, so he could see how we had put the guidelines in place and make recommendations for where we could further improve, which there's not a lot more that we can do, but we're still looking at future lighting retrofits and other mechanical equipment.
When you say lighting retrofits, are you talking about like new technology that would include like LEDs and that sort of thing? Or?
Yeah, we're looking into that. There is some controversy over what the most effective lighting is. And so at this time, it's just a preliminary discussion.
So how would a decision like that come about? Would the school board take action, or would this be an administrative thing? Or?
To be honest with you, I think that there would have to be school board level, and also, you know, the maintenance and facilities and CBJ would be involved because it would be anytime we do a renovation or anything like that, it's a capital funding type project.
Adrian, are there other energy issues that are facing the school district?
In all honesty, I feel like we're doing a really, really good job. And just if people stay on board, I believe that we've started an energy conservation program that can continue to sustain itself. And, you know, just the areas that we can improve in is just people remembering a little bit more often to turn their lights off, turn their computers off, if they're not, you know, needing to have, be using something, just shut it off.
Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Adrian Schwartz, Energy Manager with the Juneau School District, about the program she oversees to save energy throughout the school system. Join us next week as we continue to look at the energy aspects of sustainability for Juneau. Just coming up on a minute before 1 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're at K269 AO. That's at 101.7 MHz on the FM dial. Gustavus hears K201 AM on 88.1. We repeat our signal in Hoona on K220BT at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear KTOO on K210AS, that's at 89.9 MHz. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN, our sister station, is heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873, and we're also online at www.ktoo.org. There's a high wind warning out for Juneau. It starts at 6 p.m. this evening, goes to 6 a.m. Alaska time on Thursday. And the gusts downtown on Wednesday could go up as high as 70 miles per hour, so tie everything down.